When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie. I'm the titular Sean.
And I'm the very titular Carrie.
And this is the show that takes you inside the unbelievable, the unexplainable, the macabre, and the bizarre, and tries to find an answer. Hello, Caroline.
Hello, Sean.
This is part two of our series, our two-part series on the Fermi Paradox, which, if you didn't listen to our last episode, A, you know, probably go back. It'll make this make a lot more sense. But B, the Fermi Paradox is the apparent contradiction between the high probability of advanced alien life being out there somewhere in our galaxy and the total lack of evidence for advanced alien life that we have anywhere here on Earth.
So they say.
So they say. And that's part of our episode this week, certainly, Carrie. Last week, we talked about Enrico Fermi, the physicist who the paradox is named for, and the lunchtime conversation with his friends at Los Alamos Laboratory that kind of spawned this whole concept.
Mm-hmm.
We also covered the first two answers to the Fermi Paradox, the first one being that intelligent alien life isn't as common as we would assume out there, in fact, that it's rare or non-existent in the galaxy, in the universe. And the second being that intelligent alien life might be common, but it never gets far enough to reach interplanetary exploration, colonization, that kind of thing. Because extinction events or your own bitter hubris undo you before you can get to that technological stage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, Caroline, it's funny. I talked to my sister earlier today on the phone about our previous episode, and she said, that's always been her answer to the Fermi Paradox, is that we probably will just kill ourselves eventually, and that's what all civilizations do around the time of development where we are.
And your sister's a doctor, right?
My sister's a biomedical engineer.
That's a hope for humanity there.
That doesn't make her an astrophysicist.
It makes her super smart.
She is one of the smartest people I know. To me, though, periodic self-inflicted apocalypses are just a little pessimistic as a theory, because it rests on every species ever. Everyone who reaches almost spaceflight blows themselves up with nukes or destroys their planet before they get there every time.
Well, I mean, periodic self-inflicted apocalypses is what I'd call my teenage years. So who knows? It could be something that happens to everyone.
Just one of those phases.
Yeah.
Except this is a phase where you kill yourself.
Well.
Not the teen one.
No, the whole world one.
But let's move on from those grim prospects, Carrie. All of our answers for the Fermi Paradox this week rest on the assumption that there is, somewhere out there, advanced extraterrestrial civilizations, and maybe lots of them.
Okay.
As you recall, that's what people like Frank Drake and Carl Sagan argue, as we'll get to a little later in today's episode. As we'll cover later in this episode, Stephen Hawking is kind of that same belief. The universe is so big, there has to be other life out there, not only as advanced as us, but far more advanced, one would think.
One would hope.
So where are they, Carrie? Well, our next answer for the Fermi Paradox suggests that maybe advanced extraterrestrial civilizations are out there, but they're not coming, and they never will.
Hmm.
That could be because, let's see, well, what if colonization of space is impossible?
Space as in other planets?
Yeah, other star systems. Because our current understanding of physics depends on Albert Einstein's general relativity.
Mm-hmm.
And under general relativity, it seems to be theoretically impossible for anything to move faster than the speed of light.
Right. So this is going by the theory that that's correct. It is a set thing in the universe. No one's ever figured it out, even using, I don't know, like black holes, wormholes, things like that. And it's just something that can't be done.
Right. And I think wormholes are highly theoretical. The idea that you would like go into one place and come out another place. The important thing to note here, of course, is that we don't actually know very much. Our understanding of physics, the most brilliant physicist in the world will tell you that our understanding of physics is very limited still.
Yeah, which is kind of frightening.
Yeah, we're worlds away from
dark matter and all that.
We're worlds away from the apple falling on Isaac Newton's head, but we don't really understand what makes the universe work.
Yeah, what grew that apple?
And so it's possible, well, a tree. And so it's possible that,
metaphorically, Sean.
It's possible that if our understanding of physics is not correct, or if there's some way to get around that general relativity thing, maybe you could accelerate objects faster than that. But let's just say, for the sake of argument, that the fastest anything can move is the speed of light.
Okay.
Okay. Proxima Centauri is the closest star to Earth. And it's
Is that the North Star?
No, that's Sirius. And that's the brightest for other reasons, or one of the brightest.
Hmm.
I don't understand them, which is why I'm not enumerating them here. Proxima Centauri is 4.26 light years from Earth.
And you're saying this is the closest one that's not the sun?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. The sun is a lot closer than that.
Okay.
So that is the closest star to us.
And what is a light year? How long is that in people years?
Well, it's not a measure of time. It's a measure of distance. A light year, let's see what it is in miles. It almost doesn't matter because it's such a huge... It is 5.879 to the 12th power.
Okay.
So I think that means 12 zeros you slap on there. That's how many miles a light year is. What a light year is the distance that light travels in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how far you would get in a year at the speed of light. So 4.26 light years away, that means if we can't break that barrier, the closest star to our star system is more than 8 years round trip away.
Mm-hmm.
And that's if we could get to that speed.
Right.
To put this distance another way, if the sun, our sun, the one that keeps us warm, was 1 meter away, Alpha Centauri, which is in the same star system as Proxima Centauri,
mm-hmm.
It's 4.3 light years away. That would be 276 kilometers from us. It's about 172 miles, which is like the distance from Manhattan to Providence, Rhode Island.
Right.
And the sun is like a meter away from us.
Okay. Okay.
So the distances we're dealing
it's with... It's just so big that I can't even comprehend it.
Now, how big is a galaxy?
How big is a galaxy?
Well, the galactic center is about 26,670 light years from Earth.
This is our galactic center, the Milky Way.
The center of our galaxy. And keep in mind that there are billions of galaxies.
Yeah. Okay.
So it would take light 26,000 years, plus or minus 670 or so, to get from the center of the galaxy to here. Human civilization, generously speaking, depending on how you define civilization, human civilization might be about 11,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means if a conquering army was launched during the Neolithic Revolution to come to Earth and take us over, they're still 15,000 years away now.
Wow.
Assuming they're moving at the speed of light.
Well, maybe they are heading over. They're just doing it very, very slowly.
So this is a concept that I first kind of came across in our friend Isaac Arthur. We mentioned him last week.
Mm-hmm.
A futurist you can find on YouTube and watch his very trippy, heady... futurism science fiction videos. Not science fiction.
And we say it's trippy because it's so mind-blowing, the stuff that he gets across, the concepts and the math and all that. You'll understand it in a way that you might not have before, and even then it's barely in your grasp unless I guess you're a genius, which he is, and we are not.
Arthur points out that if FTL, faster than light travel, is not possible, it might not even be worth it, even if it were possible, to administer a galactic space empire.
What about GTL?
I don't know what that is.
Gym Tan Laundry.
Of course.
From Jersey Shore.
And we know the aliens always live by GTL.
Got to.
That's why they're so pumped.
Swole.
It is possible. So, again, with those kinds of distances, let's say a galactic center empire was administrating things out here on the edges of the colonies, and Earth was one of their colonies. It takes 26,000 years to send a message to your furthest out colonies?
Yeah, I guess so. It's kind of like sending a text to your grandparents.
Because don't forget, we would also assume communication is essentially light, right? The fastest you can expect a message to move is also light speed.
Sure.
And so, again...
that could completely not be the case. I'm just going to agree with you.
Again, with our current understanding of physics. That's how fast light moves. That's how fast a message travels. How can you administer a space empire if it takes thousands of years for messages to get anywhere?
I don't know, Sean. I think about this a lot.
Now, it is possible that rather than expanding across the galaxy or the universe, species might migrate from world to world or establish a few colonies in nearby systems to protect themselves from extinction. Kind of, you know, well, let's not put all our eggs in one basket. Maybe Earth could get over to Proxima Centauri in a couple thousand years, establish a colony, and then if an asteroid wipes this place out, there's still humans out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's unlikely, according to some astrophysicists, that anyone would be able to expand very far at any one time without kind of these civilizations losing contact or these settlements losing contact over the vast distance of space.
Sure. I mean, they're still 1,000 years away. How are you going to say, hey, we need food or something like that?
So instead,
it's going to be irrelevant by the time you get it.
So instead, as your population increases and your... energy needs increase as your civilization grows and becomes more advanced, maybe instead you colonize your own star system.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now we're back to the Dyson Sphere.
Got to.
For those of you who missed, again, just go back and listen to last week, but a Dyson Sphere it's a concept come up with by this physicist Freeman Dyson.
Not a vacuum,
not the inventor of the vacuum, quite an interesting thinker and physicist and futurist, who died last year. Dyson conceived of a Dyson sphere that could provide for kind of an end state civilization's energy needs, where over time you would construct a series of bands or belts around the sun, acting as kind of a giant solar farm and harvesting all the energy that your growing civilization needs. It's suggested that people could live on these rings as well, a little further out from the sun and climate controlled. This would be as your
they
sun...
They would have to be very climate controlled.
This would be as your sun cools millions of years into the future.
Mm-hmm.
You would eventually end up with ring structures around the sun where it's still warm, and that's where your populations would live. Or we could colonize the gas giants in our solar system, right, by... harvesting the materials there to build some kind of superstructures, moons orbiting those. The point is, if you heavily construct it inside your own star system, maybe nobody would notice it from a couple of light years away, and aliens could be doing this all over the place, and we just don't see it, because how could we?
Could be.
This is related to another idea that I find very interesting, and this is Isaac Arthur-y as well. I've seen a video of his on this.
You mean like scientific?
Yes.
That's our term for...
No, I just always think of Isaac Arthur when I'm thinking of like end state humanity stuff. Humanity at the end of the universe kind of things, which is a great series of videos he has. So it's been suggested that before developing the technology and the wherewithal to travel and colonize the galaxy, we've just established that would be really hard.
Yeah.
And in fact, even humanity's own very limited spaceflight so far has come at absurd, tremendous cost. It cost so much money to get us to the moon.
And maybe lives, if you look at The Lost Cosmonauts, episode 34.
That's right. Even in very near to our Earth, even in low Earth orbit, space is terrifying and not where we're supposed to be. And building crafts or environments that can support human life in space, let alone travel from one star to another, is incredibly costly and difficult and scary. It might be easier to just invent the Matrix. And that has been seriously suggested as an answer to the Fermi paradox.
Like uploading consciousness to the web?
It has certainly been suggested that consciousness upload might be a more feasible technology than spaceflight. So that...
It seems crazy, but...
And if it is, that would mean, if it's cheaper to get there, that means any civilization who could achieve spaceflight might achieve consciousness upload first. And then if you're all living in a computer and surfing the internet happily for the rest of your days, who's exploring space? Nobody. So maybe that's it, Carrie. Maybe the aliens are all out there just surfing the internet at home. You don't even need the consciousness upload full Matrix thing to have this necessarily, if just entertainment technologies and virtual reality and stuff improve to the point where people don't really have any need to look out into the universe anymore. If you can provide for your own biological needs on Earth and entertain yourselves endlessly, maybe that's where space programs end.
Yeah, maybe the aliens have, like, alien YouTube, and they just look at alien cat videos all the time, and they give up on spaceflight.
Absolutely. And looking way into the future, Isaac Arthur, our friend, has even hypothesized a Dyson sphere around a dying star that is basically just a big computer with the entire race's consciousnesses uploaded into it.
Into the sphere?
Into the Dyson sphere, which is a bunch of computers rotating the sun.
Uh-huh.
And those people will just live in perceived forever heaven.
But what if something hits the sphere? Like an asteroid? Or what if the star explodes or whatever?
Well, eventually the star will die. And that'll be the end of that civilization. But they'll also... It's possible you could extend your own if you're in a digital form. You could make time subjectively whatever you want to, right?
If you say so, I don't know.
Maybe.
Is this like when I speed up or slow down The Sims?
Exactly like that. And so they're just living forever and the last heartbeat of the universe orbiting a dying star.
Okay. It was your birthday yesterday, wasn't it?
And this is all I want.
to make me sad.
I want to be in the Matrix orbiting a dying star. I don't really. This is pretty good, what we got now.
Okay. The concept, unless we are in the Matrix.
Right, and of course that has been suggested too.
Sure has, by the Matrix.
Right, well, and many others. Rene Descartes, first among them.
Ugh, whatever. More like Rene DeFart.
So we've established it's really difficult. There's a lot of theoretical constraints to space exploration.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to Freeman Dyson, because another one of his ideas illustrates the possible reality of what human space exploration could look like. Dyson had a thought experiment called the Astro Chicken. He first mentioned it in his book Disturbing the Universe in 1979, although I think he took the Astro Chicken name after somebody made fun of him at like a lecture. What do you mean? It's like an Astro Chicken? And he just started using that. So what this would be is a 1 kilogram artificially intelligent spacecraft.
A chicken?
No, an Astro Chicken is not a chicken at all.
Okay.
It's a 1 kilogram spacecraft fusing biological and technological concepts. And it would be launched into space by a conventional rocket as kind of an egg that would then, at a pre-programmed point, grow and change, grow itself a couple of solar energy converters and collectors and use those to power some ion drive engines that it would use to fly around the universe. It wouldn't be able to, presumably, move faster than the speed of light, but there wouldn't be any people on board wasting their whole lives getting somewhere. It would take in fuel and food, quote unquote, from planetary surfaces. Like it would land on planets it found and take in ice and hydrocarbons that it could use to fuel its processes. And it would also take readings that it could then transmit back to Earth whenever it had a kind of a clear signal path.
Can it reproduce?
Well, that's an interesting point, Carrie. A related idea, it's actually called a von Neumann probe.
Ooh.
After physicist John von Neumann.
I'm sure he called something else his von Neumann probe.
Von Neumann never talked about a von Neumann probe exactly, but he did a lot of thought experiments with self-replicating machines. He was kind of the first to talk a lot about that concept. And so if you built this Astro Chicken type spaceship, but you also gave it a factory kind of component to build another Astro Chicken, now you've got a self-replicating machine that can go out there and explore the whole universe for you if you give it enough time.
Sure, because, you know, you just send one Astro Chicken out, it might die somehow, and then what's the point?
Yeah, of course. But if you sent many of them out, some could even be specialized to take on different functions, like, for example, preparing a settlement for colonization. If we get really good at terraforming, we could have one of these little spaceships that flies to a planet and starts making it livable.
And this is like biotechnological?
It's unclear to me. Freeman Dyson talked about it being a biotechnological thing. I don't know if he means that it would literally be partially alive, or if he just means we would borrow concepts from biology. Like, he thought that when it was in planetary atmospheres, it would move around using a thruster similar to a bombardier beetle, which just takes in, it generates chemicals from the stuff it's taking in its food, and then fires the chemicals out to move around.
It farts? It
yeah.
Farts,
so this would
it's
be
like
a
Jigglypuff in Super Smash Brothers.
Yes, it farts around the stage and sends people to sleep. So the Astro Chicken would be farting around space.
As you do. And aren't we all just farting around space?
You could have some of them terraform planets, and you could even seed a spaceship like this with embryos of humans, or just genetic material that it could make embryos out of, stuff from other Earth life, and you could send that out to create colonies for you.
This seems impossibly difficult to do.
Well, this isn't like tomorrow's technology.
No.
But it is.
But that seems closer than interplanetary or like interstellar travel.
I think that's one of the most it's one of the most feasible methods that's been suggested for human interstellar exploration and travel.
That's trippy. And then something like this could possibly gain consciousness and evolve to being its own kind of life form
in a
what
way.
What if it came back? That seems like a sci-fi novel.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, Carrie. There's a very similar concept in a sci-fi novel series called Berserker by Frank Saberhagen, in which a precursor race to humanity called the Creators, who only have some trace remnants left in the whole universe, made at some point a weapon bent on destroying all organic life. They made it to win a war against another alien species called the Red Race. But the problem is the Berserkers, which were human to planet-sized, artificially intelligent weapons who could make more Berserkers, took their mandate a little too seriously, realized their creators were organic life, and turned on them. The Creators were totally destroyed, and the Berserkers roamed the galaxy until, in Fred Saberhagen's novels, they come upon humanity.
Did the Creators live on Earth?
No.
Okay, so this was just a separate thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's also not real. This is all science fiction.
No, I know. I'm just... even science fiction is hard to follow.
The point is, this kind of backs into another possible explanation for the Fermi paradox. Because self-replicating probes could be created, like I said, to seed life or to kill it, right? And so... well, let's back up. If one species rises to galactic exploration, if one species is doing that, whether they're breaking the light speed barrier or whatever they're doing, they'll have such a massive technological advantage over the next species to emerge, what, 1,000 years later? Now these spacefarers already have a 1,000-year head start on everybody else moving around the galaxy. Huge tech advantage. Maybe they're not nice guys.
Yeah, I think that's always one of the possibilities with aliens.
And so maybe new advanced civilizations or pre-advanced civilizations are systematically destroyed before they have a chance to germinate. This is kind of like the last thing we covered in the last episode where humanities always kill themselves before they get to space.
Now, this is another race that kills you before you get to space.
Yes. It's not a totally unique concept. The Berserker thing actually kind of reminds me of the engineers from Alien.
Mm-hmm.
Who, it's never really explicitly explored. I mean, it's explored plenty. It's never explicitly stated in those movies. But it's
certainly not Prometheus.
Well, Prometheus comes the closest, probably.
Yeah, but it's not explicit about anything.
But in Prometheus, what we know from that movie is that the engineers created humans. They continued to observe humans throughout the years. They didn't quite like the way that humanity was going. They decided to wipe the project, and they created deadly, horrible, mutating bioweapons to do it.
Why didn't they just blow up the Earth?
Why didn't they just blow up the Earth? That's a good question. Maybe they wanted to do something else with it. You know, in Dragon Ball Z, the Saiyans wipe out all life on a planet, but not to conquer it, just so they can kind of refurbish it and sell it, flip it. They're world flippers.
So it's basically like a really nice mid-century modern coffee table you find at Goodwill?
Yeah, it's exactly like that, except it's Earth.
Yeah, I mean, except that.
But the engineers reminded me of that, because I think ultimately the engineers fall victim to their creations as well, whether that's the black liquid from Prometheus or the xenomorph.
Sure. It'll get ya.
It'll get ya.
Hubris.
Maybe there is life out there, but maybe the slow spread of civilization across the galaxy and all the things standing in its way, maybe that just means that we are living in kind of a galactic backwater, which was the premise from that first lunchtime conversation Fermi had with his buddies, that we're just in the sticks.
We're in the galactic Florida swamp.
Yes. In 2019, a University of Rochester astrophysicist named Adam Frank published a paper where he ran a ton of computer simulations about how galactic colonization might proceed. He assumed slower than light travel, as we are. Again, Alpha Centauri, 4 light years away from Earth. That means, let's say, any star is an 8-year-round trip. However, Frank and his colleagues found that in their, you know, irregular orbits and movements around the galaxy, stars do occasionally swing closer to one another. And you can predict these movements. So if an advanced species took that into account, they could knock some time off of their trips by just jumping to stars when they swing closer. And they found that maybe the galaxy is pretty conquerable in, like, a couple hundred million years, given the right conditions.
Oh, okay. Seems doable.
Over all the simulations that they ran, Frank said that, and this part's going to seem fairly obvious, in universes where good planets were plentiful, civilizations expanded and flourished and conquered most of the galaxy. In universes where livable planets were rare, life never really got off the ground anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
However, he said there was a third category of simulations where some parts of the universe remained unconquered for long stretches or indefinitely.
Why was that?
Because worlds die off, worlds lose contact. Remember that we're talking about thousands of years to get messages back and forth. So whole stretches of civilizations fall out of contact, and maybe a bunch of your worlds die before you even hear they're having problems.
Hmm. That's like me with my plants.
Yes.
When I remember to water them again, they're dead. Shit, I should water those flowers upstairs.
Yeah, exactly. You couldn't run a space empire, Carrie.
Oh, no. 100% not. It's hard enough for me to keep Poe alive.
She has a black thumb.
I do.
Now, in this third category of simulations, parts of the galaxy, for those various reasons, stayed unconquered, unsettled for millions of years at a time. And that's long enough. If there's a million year window where this part of the galaxy is not conquered, that's long enough that we wouldn't see any traces of the last contact here on Earth, even if aliens were around at some point.
Got it.
Gotcha. Contact might be the wrong word because there might not have been people here at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's also possible that aliens are closer than we think. Maybe they're everywhere, right? Maybe it's not about the distances involved. Maybe FTL travel is possible. And if it's possible, somebody out there has probably achieved it. Which brings us back to our Fermi paradox. Where are they? Some have suggested the zoo hypothesis. Can you take a guess at what that is, Carrie? You might even have heard of it.
My guess would be that we are some other race's pet and they just observe us.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, so this concept was first seen in science fiction, as far as I can tell, in Olaf Stapledon's novel Star Maker from 1937, but it's since been used by Arthur C. Clarke and Orson Scott Card and others.
Love Olaf Stapledon.
Even
big Olaf head.
Even in Star Trek, the crew of the Enterprise follows the Prime Directive, right? And they don't interfere with any world's development.
Mm-hmm.
So under this theory, aliens would avoid interplanetary contamination, so to speak, and allow life to reach a certain point of civilization before they tried to make contact. Or maybe they would allow other life to reach out first rather than ever making initial contact.
Mm, like Alien Bumble.
It's worth... What? Oh, because the lady makes the first message?
Yes.
Sure. And we are the lady.
Mm-hmm. They call it Mother Earth, after all.
We actually do a similar thing with uncontacted tribes right here on Earth in, mm-hmm. say, Papua New Guinea or something like that. It's illegal to go and talk to these people because we don't want to contaminate their way of life and spread disease. But it's mostly really because the international community has kind of agreed that these people have a right to their culture. And there's no question that contact with the outside world would destroy it forever.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe aliens are doing a similar thing. However, if the universe is teeming with life, if there's tons of aliens out there, it seems a little unlikely that everybody would fall in line with this kind of a mandate. So I think the zoo hypothesis needs either a universal big boss who's really got everybody else in line, a galactic civilization or
a Thanos
empire, right? Maybe there's just only one civilization out there to worry about. Because if there were a bunch, it would only take one civilization not falling in line to blow up the zoo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I could mean that literally, or I could just mean figuratively. Now, it's also possible that advanced extraterrestrial life is out there, but we can't see them because we're not listening right. Or because we just haven't waited long enough. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, as we covered last week, scans distant stars for signs of life constantly. But what are signs of life?
Well, they're just signs of life based on our knowledge of life.
Yes, exactly. They're looking for radio and light radiation from technology leakage or from communications technology.
But maybe they're not using radio waves and things like that.
Yes, that's right. Carrie, Earth has only been transmitting radio waves for like 150 years, maybe? Maybe?
Maybe, yeah.
And we're already transmitting a lot less of them because we're switching a lot of our television and radio and internet over to lossless fiber optic cables instead of broadcasting. And given the short period of time, it just seems like civilizations, if they make radio noise at all, might only do it for a very brief period of time. And on a time scale for a civilization of thousands or millions of years, they basically don't create them at all.
Mm-hmm. Just a tiny blip.
Some have suggested we should be looking for neutrinos instead. The idea that neutrino communications that we don't have any knowledge of or way to do yet could come into being. Neutrinos are like neutrons, but they're teeny tiny. Their mass is basically zero. I don't know. I don't know physics. Don't look at me like that.
I'll believe you. Whatever. Sure. Neutrinos.
All I can tell you is big ear telescope astronomers have speculated that advanced aliens might be able to communicate that way.
All right.
But
you could tell me that they communicate through clogging. I'll believe you. I don't know.
But for now, we're scanning for radio and light signals. And we're sending them, too, occasionally. The Arecibo message was sent out in 1974 by SETI from the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. It was written by, this won't surprise you, Frank Drake and Carl Sagan.
I thought I was going to be like, John Arecibo.
The message was, follow me here.
Oh boy.
The message was 1,679 binary digits, ones and zeros, 1,679 of them, because the only way to divide that out, it's the product of two prime numbers. So the only way to divide it out is 73 by 23, if you arrange the numbers in a grid.
Okay.
It's the only way you could put it into a box, is a 73 by 23 box. And if you do that, it creates a picture, the ones and the zeros do.
Mm-hmm.
In that picture, Frank Drake and Carl Sagan included the numbers 1 through 10, the atomic numbers of hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus, the chemical formula for DNA nucleotides, and the estimated number of nucleotides in a person, along with a graphic of a double helix, the average physical height of humans, along with a little picture of a human, and a number listing Earth's population at the time, a graphic of the solar system that pointed at Earth, and a graphic of the Arecibo radio telescope with a reading of its diameter. So, hey, aliens, if you can read this, here we are. This is what we are. This is what we're listening with.
They figured that numbers are so universal that aliens would probably be able to figure that out.
Well, they beamed this message to star cluster M13. And Drake and Sagan both said that this is more of a celebration of human technological achievement, the idea that we can do this, than actual communication with extraterrestrials. Because aliens probably, numbers aren't, we made numbers up. They're not universal. Aliens wouldn't be able to read binary. They probably don't know what numbers are. Their understanding of mathematics is probably, or at least might be, different than ours.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, cluster M13 is 25,000 light years away. So that message is going to take a while to get there.
Yeah. How? So it was transmitted through radio waves?
Yeah.
So it's just traveling in space.
At roughly the speed of light towards star cluster M13.
And they're just hoping that someone has something to receive that message.
I don't think they even really are. It was a stunt. It was a publicity stunt.
Probably a very expensive one.
I don't think it was. Like, Carl Sagan's got some time on his hands. Or throw some digits together? Sure.
I guess.
Now, we've also received transmissions that some believe are extraterrestrial in origin. The most famous of these is the WOW signal.
Love the WOW signal.
Which was discovered on August 15th, 1977 by Jerry R. Ehrman. He was a physicist working at the Big Ear Radio Telescope, which I just mentioned.
Oh, I thought you were just making fun of their big ears.
No, it's literally a big ear. And that's what it's called.
It's like, that's not very nice for these nerds.
These things are never creatively named. The Big Ear, the Large Hadron Collider.
Oh, the Big Ear is kind of fun.
Anyway, this is a big telescope at Ohio State University. And Jerry Ehrman noted that while the constantly rotating telescope passed the direction of the Sagittarius constellation, it received an unmodulated continuous wave, like a sine wave, which would just sound like...
That's beautiful.
For 72 seconds.
Every time.
Well, it was just 72 seconds and then it was gone.
But like when the telescope swung back, did it do the same thing in the same area? Or was it just that one time?
It was just that one time. The telescope actually has two horns and only one of them picked up the frequency. And it's impossible to tell which one because of the way the telescope works.
Now, I know this, but why did he call it the WOW frequency?
Well, because, and you can see a picture of this. Actually, we should post a picture on the page for this episode. On the readout from the machine, Ehrman circled the readings of the 1420 megahertz signal and wrote in red pen, "Wow!" exclamation point.
It's so second grade teacher. I love it.
Unfortunately for Ehrman, it was never found again and he even admitted we should have seen it again. We looked 50 times.
Unless it was only transmitted once. Why would you see it again? Maybe it's just a minute-long signal, and that was it.
That's true, but we've never seen another flash of information coming from that part of the galaxy.
Well, maybe they only sent the one, and that's when it hit us.
It's been suggested, most depressingly, that it could just be an Earth signal reflected off some space debris. But it's worth noting that 1420 megahertz is a protected spectrum for strictly astronomical use, and you're not allowed to broadcast on it on Earth.
I mean, yeah, but since when has that stopped anyone?
Yeah, it's true, but it might be hard to get equipment that broadcasts at that frequency, but that doesn't mean no one does or has.
Sagan?
More recently, efforts to listen for alien life have gotten a little more cred, a little more pull, a little more big, most notably with Breakthrough Listen that was started in January 2016. It's a 10-year project, and all the money's coming from this Russian billionaire. But it's being worked on by Frank Drake, and Stephen Hawking was actually a big part of the kind of genesis of this project. He actually said at its launch, "In an infinite universe, there must be other life. There is no bigger question. It is time to commit to finding the answer."
Fair enough.
That's what Hawking believed until the day that he died. Breakthrough Listen is currently scanning stars for radio signals from the Green Banks Observatory and the Parkes Observatory, which are the first and second largest steerable telescopes in the world.
Steerable?
Steerable.
Oh.
You can move them.
I was like, I could steer the telescope we have upstairs.
It's also looking for laser transmissions using the Automated Planet Finder, which is another telescope that, as it sounds, is automated.
I hope that's trademarked.
It's at the Lick Observatory.
Lick?
Mm-hmm. That's our old friend Lick. Breakthrough Listen's plan is to search 1 million nearby stars, as well as the centers of 100 other galaxies. It is going to search 10 times more sky than any project before it and scan the entire 1 to 10 gigahertz range of...
It's going to do all this within 10 years?
Yeah, that's what they say. They were, for the first couple of years of the project, they were heavily using crowd computing, which is kind of cool. They had the SETI at home program that you could... They released it in the 90s. You could install it on your computer, and what it would do is just, in the background, use whatever processing power you weren't using to crunch data for SETI all the time.
That seems like it could be used for ill, though.
Yeah, well, last year, I'm not going to find it right now, and I don't know what it was, but last year I think I saw a crowd computing thing used for another purpose. If listeners know what it was, get back at me.
That sounds familiar to me, too.
But I think it was something I was in favor of. I don't remember.
Might also be part of the Bitcoin mining, which I really don't understand, but I know it takes a lot of processing power.
I do think people work to put their processors together on those as well, yes. Those two big telescopes are looking for leakage like the leakage you see off the Earth. And they say Earth-level leakage would be detectable from 5 parsecs away, which is a distance that apparently covers the 43 closest stars to Earth. They also claim that they would be able to detect technology the size of an aircraft radar in the nearest 1,000 stars.
Okay.
Here are their results so far. On 8/30/17, there were 15 radio bursts from a dwarf galaxy 3 billion light years away. No more information has been gathered, but obviously extraterrestrial life can't be ruled out. No other readings have come from that galaxy. In December 2020, a 982 megahertz signal was detected from Proxima Centauri-ish, somewhere around that star. It has been called Breakthrough Listen Candidate 1.
Not as catchy as Wow Signal.
It's not, but it is called by, like, it's pretty agreed upon that that's the first signal since the Wow Signal that's on par with it in terms of, like, wow.
It's the Yowza Signal.
It's the Yow Signal. Of course, given the crazy distances, there could be advanced life out there where we can't see them. The Arecibo telescope we mentioned would be able to see Earth up to 0.3 light years away, as far as its energy goes. And of course, that's less than a tenth of the distance to Proxima Centauri.
Mm-hmm.
Even if someone was trying to reach us, we would have to be scanning the right area of space and the right band of frequencies. And if your civilization lasts 10,000 years and the next one over is 1,000 years away, it's unlikely you're going to get much of a meaningful dialogue going.
Sure.
It's also possible that, well, look, we're not broadcasting, other than the Arecibo message and a few other gimmicks. We're just listening to see if we can hear aliens. What if there's other life in the universe and they're all just doing the same thing? That's
everyone's listening and no one's talking.
Yes, that's been suggested. That's actually literally what they say.
With my knowledge of people and especially men, I don't think that's very likely.
Well, Carrie, keep in mind, we only know of one civilization and 100% of them do this. Humans. It's the official policy of SETI that, quote, no response to a signal or other evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence should be sent until appropriate international consultations take place.
But they did send out the Arecibo signal. And that's contact, isn't it?
That was a celebration of human technological achievement.
Well, it's technically a message sent to wherever it was being sent to.
Yeah, sure. So was the 35-year anniversary of Arecibo when the Arecibo Observatory beamed 10,000 tweets out to the same star cluster, hashtagged Chasing UFOs to promote Discovery Channel's Chasing UFOs series,
no,
along with verbal messages from celebrities, including Stephen Colbert.
Well, at least there's that. I like him as an ambassador to alien kind.
So do I, but again, it's 35 years behind the first message they sent out, and they're both still a couple thousand years away.
The aliens get here like several thousand years from now. I want the funny late night guy. The Colbert.
Take me to your Colbert. This is the longest into an episode that we've gone to our first break, Carrie.
Sure is, yeah.
It's gotten out of control. But when we come back, I'm going to cover the last answer to the Fermi paradox. They're already here.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out, and I can no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. or wherever fine podcasts are found.
You're here, which means you love podcasts. But are you looking for another kind of entertainment on the go? Audible is the leading provider of spoken word entertainment and audiobooks, ranging from bestsellers to memoirs, news, business, and more. By signing up for a free trial at www.audibletrial.com/ain'titscary, you'll receive access to thousands of titles with one credit toward any audiobook and two Audible originals, free during your trial and then with subscription each month after. Personally, my favorite Audible title is also my favorite book, It by Stephen King. I went into this audiobook ready to judge because I've loved this novel since I was a kid. But between the stellar production value and the truly breathtaking narration performance by actor Steven Weber, I was 100% all in. If you like this podcast and have a strong stomach, I think you will be too. Not into audiobooks? No problem. With podcasts, theatrical performances, guided meditations, and more, Audible offers something for everyone. So what are you waiting for? Get started now. And hey, you'll be helping support the podcast. Visit our link at www.audibletrial.com/ain'titscary for a free trial. That's www.audibletrial.com/ain'titscary. Audible. Listen more.
Welcome back. When last we left you, we covered the next couple of answers to the Fermi paradox, just the ideas that maybe extraterrestrial life is out there, but they're not coming, or we can't hear them.
Or that they're listening and not sending any signals to us.
It's also possible, though, Carrie, that they're already here.
I know plenty of people that would tell you the same thing.
And that's where we get into UFO conspiracy theory.
Yay!
Because if aliens are here and people have noticed, it's very unlikely that the government has not noticed. And that would mean that they're actively hiding the presence of UFOs and extraterrestrials from humanity.
Spoiler alert, we'll be talking a little about this in our news segment this week.
We're going to be talking about this all the time on this podcast, but this is a nice broad strokes background version of it.
Lots happening right now in the UFO official government sphere.
For a lot of people, American UFO conspiracy theory starts with Roswell, 1947, when, of course, the U.S. Air Force announced through a press release that a flying disc, quote-unquote, had been recovered near Roswell, New Mexico. Within a few days, they recanted that story, withdrew the press release, and officials say that they had just misidentified a weather balloon.
Typical.
Now, in the early 90s, of course, by the way, interestingly, conspiracies didn't really spring up around the Roswell stuff until the 70s, for the most part. That's when the ufology really...
That's when everyone was doing LSD and feeling trippy and connected to the universe.
Talk about Roswell conspiracies and people claiming they had seen corpses of little green men and people who claimed they had stolen pieces of the wreckage, etc., etc., grew throughout the 70s and 80s until in the early 90s, the Air Force went back and did another report on Roswell, an internal investigation, after which they determined that the balloons that had been recovered in the Roswell incident were from Project Mogul, which was not technically a weather balloon project, but they were microphones they were putting on balloons to send way up and listen for Russian nuclear tests.
Sure, whatever. I will say that I think Project Blue Book was canceled or ended in 69, up top my brother. So that's probably why a lot of the stuff came out in the 70s, because there were a bunch of out of work scientists blabbing to people. Some things were declassified. Seems like the time frame works.
That's right. Project Blue Book, for those of you who don't know, was started in March 1952 as the government's... way of investigating UFO reports.
It was basically our X-Files.
It was a very Mulder and Scully thing. And like you said, it lasted...
Just like us.
Lasted till December 1969, over which period the Air Force investigated thousands of UFO claims. The guy in charge was an Edward J. Ruppelt. And when it was started, you might remember Ruppelt, Carrie, if our listeners want to go back to our George Adamski episode. Ruppelt actually went to Adamski's hamburger stand as one of his early Blue Book assignments.
Yeah, this was episode 7 or 8.
Yeah,
of ours.
Real early. Oh, we've come so long. We've come a long way, baby.
And yet we have light years to go.
The conclusions of Project Blue Book at the end of its 17-year run were as follows. No UFO evaluated by the U.S. Air Force had been a national security threat. Nothing investigated by the U.S. Air Force had been impossible given modern known technology. And there was no evidence that any of the unidentified vehicles were piloted by extraterrestrials.
That's at least what they've told us.
Now, you can look through Project Blue Book's files. You can read all of them. At least all
and nothing's redacted.
Oh, things are redacted.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's not explanations given for every one of these UFOs. Some of them are definitely left unidentified. Blue Book just said that there wasn't any evidence that it came from another planet.
Okay. There's no evidence that Poe didn't come from another planet.
For his part, Edward Ruppelt felt that the USAF had been schizophrenic, the Air Force, had been schizophrenic between open and transparent and secret and dismissive in their approach to aliens. And that's what gave rise to rampant conspiracy theory over the next few decades.
Yeah, sometimes covering up things that don't really need to be covered up just make things more mysterious. Mm-hmm. And make the conspiracies even bigger.
In 1956, a guy named Gray Barker released a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers.
They knew too much.
which publicized Men in Black reports from guys like Harold Dahl and Albert Bender, and gave rise to the general belief that there were these black-suited guys showing up and, you know, warning people away from alien investigation.
Albert Bender, one of our hometown boys.
The Men in Black were thought to be government agents, keeping things hush-hush. In 1984, though, maybe the biggest piece of UFO conspiracy lore came out with the Majestic 12 document. Ufologist Jamie Shandera got an envelope in the mail with some film in it, and the film had photographs of 8 pages of documents that seemed to be a briefing for Dwight D. Eisenhower in November 1952. Now, in November 1952, of course, Eisenhower had just won the presidency. And this is evidently what the executive branch felt the need to get him up to speed on before he came into office.
Yeah, because if you want to give secret information to an incoming president, the best way to do that is a document.
Absolutely. You want to write everything down and make sure the records are kept. The memorandum revealed that Harry Truman had organized a secret committee of 12 in 1952. It detailed the concealment of the Roswell crash by this group and made recommendations of how to use the recovered tech and how the U.S. under Eisenhower should deal with aliens in the future.
Wi-Fi? Was this the Wi-Fi?
I'll get to the Wi-Fi in a second.
I need to know.
We gotta wait for Eisenhower. There was a further crash in 1950 that was also mentioned in the Majestic 12 document as having been recovered.
Is this something that we know about, or was this completely new information from this document?
No, there was another crash in the another supposed crash in the vicinity of Roswell, the government said was balloons in 1950. Here's some quotes from the Majestic 12 document memo. During the course of the operation, serial reconnaissance discovered that 4 human-like beings had apparently ejected from the craft at some point before it exploded. These had fallen to Earth about 2 miles east of the wreckage site. All 4 were dead and badly decomposed due to action by predators and exposure to the elements during the approximately 1 week time period which had elapsed before their discovery. The memo goes on to talk about how, quote, civilian and military witnesses in the area were debriefed, and news reporters were given the effective cover story that the object had been a misguided weather research balloon.
Yeah, super effective, guys.
And a word about the occupants of the craft. Although these creatures are human-like in appearance, the biological and evolutionary process responsible for their development has apparently been quite different from those observed or postulated for Homo sapiens.
What was weird about them?
It didn't say in the Majestic 12 document. Well, you don't want to commit that stuff to paper, Carrie.
Oh, yeah, certainly not.
Shandera and his friends Stanton Friedman and Bill Moore, noted conspiracy theorists and alien guys, said that they received several anonymous messages after that.
After the 1984 mailing incident?
Yes, well, because obviously the Majestic 12 documents, Shandera immediately went to the public with them, and people found them not too convincing. But Shandera and his ufologist friends, Stanton Friedman and Bill Moore, started receiving anonymous messages that eventually led them to search some unclassified files in the National Archives, where they found the supposed Cutler-Twining memo. This is a document allegedly from Eisenhower assistant Robert Cutler to General Nathan Twining, and it contains a direct reference to the Majestic 12.
Interesting.
But that's been investigated by skeptics like Philip Klass, who says that, well, Robert Cutler was actually out of the country that day. And also the Truman signature on the memo was copy-pasted from a Truman memo to Vannevar Bush another day.
So the one with the Majestic 12 mention was a fake?
Yeah.
Well, that's depressing.
The FBI has investigated, and you may be surprised to know that they say the Majestic 12 is completely bogus.
Okay.
We'll have a link to where you
can... To be fair, that's like me saying that it's fact that Poe's the best boy. I know it to be true, but I'm also his mom.
Yes. You can look on the FBI website at the Majestic 12 documents, and all of them do in fact have the word bogus written across the pages in Sharpie.
Spreading it on a little thick, you guys. bogus. Come on, get over it.
Bill Moore, one of these ufologists, later said Majestic 12 might have been a disinformation campaign. He's like, well, if it wasn't real, maybe
they did this to make us look stupid.
Or, well, to make, he thought, to make U.S.'s enemies look stupid, or to distract them from legitimate U.S. Air Force projects. And that brings us into the Eisenhower era, Carrie.
Let's do it.
Conspiracy theorists claim the following.
I don't think we have time for this.
In February 1954, Eisenhower was on vacation in Palm Springs. This is real. And he missed a public dinner. He claimed to have a toothache that day and had to go to the dentist. But what former Navy Commander Charles Suggs says Eisenhower was doing that day...
Suggs?
...was meeting with aliens at Edwards Air Force Base, which is nearby Palm Springs, actually.
Why does it have to be he either has a toothache or he's meeting aliens? What if it's like he was seeing his mistress?
Well, Commander Suggs says he was in Edwards Base and saw Eisenhower have a conversation with two Nordic-looking blue-eyed aliens. You remember the Nordic-looking aliens from our friend George Adamski?
Can't forget.
So this is the influence that he had, Carrie. When we talk about, I'll talk about Pleiadians in a second. These Nordic aliens are, this is all from George, because he wanted to be around sexy blonde-haired men all the time.
Or they were from space, Sean.
Or that.
Or maybe Eisenhower was just talking to two Norwegians.
He could have been talking to two Norwegians, but Commander Suggs says Eisenhower had a pleasant discussion with the two blonde men, but wouldn't agree to cease U.S. nuclear tests. So obviously a conversation with aliens.
Still seems like they could be Norwegians.
Or German, yeah. There would be no treaty signed between Eisenhower and the Nordic aliens on that day. But the following year, busy social calendar, he was apparently meeting other aliens at Holloman Air Force Base. This according to former New Hampshire State Representative Henry McElroy. He says he saw a document while he was a member of the Veteran Affairs Committee that referred to extraterrestrials and an opportunity for the president to meet with them in 1955.
Mm-hmm.
According to ufologist Art Campbell, 300 people, he doesn't specify who they were, but he says 300 people saw Air Force One land at Holloman Air Force Base, at which point the pilot instructed the tower to turn off the radar while the president's plane was on the tarmac. Once the radar was turned off, three round objects were seen in the sky. One landed near Air Force One, while one stayed hovering overhead, and one seemed to disappear. A man, believed to be the president, descended the ramp of Air Force One, shook hands with a being at the bottom of the ramp of the saucer.
And but did he salute?
He didn't. He shook hands, and he entered. 45 minutes later, the man left. He wasn't wearing a hat.
Eisenhower?
Yep. He had lost his hat while he was inside. So when he came out, people were sure he was Eisenhower. When he went in, they were like, I think it was the president. Timothy Good, another conspiracy theorist, says that what happened there was that Ike signed a treaty with the Greys.
So these aren't even like human-ish looking.
Nope. These are things. Little guys with big heads and big black eyes. They're the Roswell aliens that you see on merch, basically.
Yeah. They're the typical X-Files aliens.
The treaty with the Greys supposedly contained the following provisions.
Now, where did Timothy get this information?
You can dig and dig in these alien conspiracy things always come back to...
No, I know from looking up like the Lost Cosmonauts and everything, there's assertions that are made across many a GeoCities website.
Yes.
But you can't ever find the original.
Can't find the originals. A lot of this stuff does come from Bill Cooper, I believe.
Ooh. He has problems.
The Pale Horse book?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, we can get into it. I think there's some racial stuff going on. It's tough. Anyway, the provisions of this agreement that Eisenhower supposedly made with the Greys are the following. They would help us develop technology, like our Wi-Fi, Caroline, like the space program that would develop over the next few years, like the internet, like computing. All of these things happened after the 1950s. Why? Aliens. In addition, the aliens would not make similar treaties and help other nations of the Earth. Now, what did they get in return for this, the Greys? You know this, Carrie.
People's sweet, sweet buttholes.
Eisenhower supposedly gave the Grey aliens permission to abduct humans for experimentation. but only if the names of the humans abducted and experimented on were always provided to the Majestic 12.
Do they have to sign off on it? No, she's my aunt's friend. She can't be abducted. Pick someone else.
Barney Hill? Yeah, sure. Touch his penis.
Make him scream.
There was one last encounter at Holloman Air Force Base, maybe, in 1964, when some witnesses saw three round craft over Holloman airspace. This was actually caught on film, these three. It's, you know, just three blurs moving weirdly, like they always are. But witnesses claim that one of these craft landed at the base, and that three humanoids in tight-fitting jumpsuits got out. So there's an ongoing communication there. When you listen to a Bill Cooper, when you listen to a Timothy Good, what do they say is out there? When we talk about aliens, what are they?
Well, usually it's a scream of,
they're coming to kill us!
Yes, of course, but I mean, what are the aliens themselves? We have three, I mentioned the Greys, right? Alien conspiracy theorists will tell you that there are no fewer than three different kinds of Greys living on this planet.
I've heard there's 50 Shades of Grey.
That's actually true. And that can get 50 Shades darker as well. The Greys that come from the Zeta Reticuli system are small. These are the small guys who you picture. These are the guys you picture.
Take me to your leader.
They're 3 or 4 feet tall. They've got the big black eyes. Zeta Reticuli Greys work for evil reptilian overlords who want to take over humanity.
Mm-hmm.
But they secretly want to work with us to overthrow their reptilian masters, supposedly. So they're good guys.
Interesting. Okay.
There are also Bellatrix Greys, who are even shorter.
Oh.
And apparently they're really mean.
Hmm. Well, that'll happen.
They don't like contact with humanity at all. Then you have the Orion Greys from, obviously, the Orion constellation. And they're very tall, 7 to 8 feet tall, with big noses.
Ew, what?
And their kind of whole thing is they just love experimenting on humans. It's their favorite.
Love those sweet, sweet buttholes.
That's right. So the Greys are kind of, you know, I don't know.
The Greys are a spectrum.
The Greys are generally presented as not trustworthy, but not necessarily evil either. It's just like humanity's a means to an end to them.
Those shifty Greys.
Then you have your Pleiadians, and these are the good aliens, the only ones that most UFO conspiracy theorists will tell you that you can trust.
Tell me these aren't the Nordic white guys.
You mean like our friend Orthon of Venus?
Is he a Pleiadian?
No, the Pleiadians are from the Pleiades, which is a star cluster.
I was starting to get concerned that it was like a racial thing, as most conspiracies tend to do, where it's like, oh, the small ones with the big noses, they're shifty and you can't trust them.
Yeah.
But you like the blonde, blue-eyed ones that are very pale and look like they're from Norway.
I don't know why you would think anything like that would be happening, Carrie. The Pleiadians are Nordic-looking, blonde, fair-skinned aliens who are the only ones who know what humanity is good for. They also created all life on Earth. And
so they're white, and they're the best.
They're not only white, they are where humanity started, and any other colors you see in humanity might be from experimentation from other aliens.
They're Aryans.
They're Aryans.
Oh, no.
This is where all conspiracy theory, if you dig deep enough,
it always hits the anti-Semitic point of no return. And that goes for, it's not just anti-Semitism, it goes for all racism, but
and so that's where we get to. And that's where we get to, I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff out there. There's Dulce Air Force Base.
Oh, we'll go into that someday.
We'll do a whole episode on that. There's a, just if you don't know, there's, after there was a rash of cattle mutilations in the late 70s near Dulce, New Mexico, this guy, Paul Benowitz, ran around in the desert listening to radio garbage and scrap signals and stuff, and eventually convinced himself and a bunch of other people that there was a joint human-alien Air Force base under Dulce, New Mexico on the Colorado border where aliens were being bred with humans to create alien-human hybrids. That's a very common thing in alien conspiracy theory because of the racial element. There's always this idea that the aliens are trying to breed with us and weaken our genetic stock, which makes me uncomfortable.
Just makes us stronger, yo. Mix it up.
Why not get some aliens in here, right?
Why not?
These days, the UFO...
I mean, maybe... You know, I have real bad allergies right now. Maybe if I mixed it up with an alien, our children wouldn't have any allergies. Horizontal, well, my children.
Horizontal gene transfer. It's just like the xenomorph again.
Horizontal gene transfer. That's what she said.
You can't. You still can't put on my jeans.
That's not what I meant, baby.
These days in the UFO conspiracy world, the biggest buzzword is disclosure.
And we'll be getting to that again in the news.
That's been the hotness since the late 90s. The Disclosure Project was founded by ufologist Stephen M. Greer in, I think, 1993?
About when X-Files came out, yeah.
But it wasn't until May 2001 when that group, and presumably still just consisting of Stephen Greer, held a press conference at the National Press Club in D.C. demanding Congress hold hearings on, quote, secret U.S. involvement with UFOs and extraterrestrials. The disclosure conversation has evolved a little bit since then. In 2017, Blink-182 guitarist Tom DeLonge started appearing at UFO conventions with, quote, very exciting news about disclosure and how he had been talking to some of the top people in government and he was going to get the alien information out there. And then it turned out that he was just starting a radio and TV company called To the Stars Academy.
Well, that wasn't just it.
With a former CIA director.
They also had other people involved, and they're doing some research, apparently.
Tom claims
To the Stars Academy.
Tom claims that To the Stars Academy will slowly disseminate information that the U.S. government has on aliens and alien technology through arts and entertainment like science fiction, and also then eventually getting us some of these technologies, like flying cars and... psychic communication that the aliens have been keeping from us.
I'm all for it. Give the Blink-182 guitarist all of the information. Why not? Do it.
In a final analysis, Carrie, which Fermi paradox answer do you feel like you want to go with? Why ain't we hanging out with aliens right now?
Well, I'm going to automatically knee-jerk my answer at least to something that includes there being life out there.
Why?
My opinion hasn't changed on the fact that I think it's improbable and almost impossible that we're the only living, quote unquote, beings in the whole universe, which is infinite, question mark. So it just seems completely absurd to me to even think that we're the only living beings, at least with some sort of consciousness.
Yeah.
So I automatically will cut out the ones that say there's nothing. But beyond that, I'm still stuck. I mean, you've provided a lot of good arguments. It could be impossible to do interplanetary travel. It could just be that you can't travel through black holes or wormholes or anything like that. What is it called in Star Wars? The super fast travel.
Hyperdrive?
Hyperdrive, yeah. That just simply does not exist anywhere. There are laws of physics, and that is one of them.
In Star Wars, there's an alternate dimension you can travel through called hyperspace, where the distances are shorter.
Yes.
And where objects in our dimension just create mass shadows rather than actually being there. That's not science, that's fantasy.
Right, but I mean, something like that, using parallel dimensions to travel, I mean, it all sounds crazy, right? It all sounds like science fiction.
In Star Trek, you've got a warp drive, you wrap a little bubble of hyperspace around your ship, and it can move real far, real fast.
Sure, why not? Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's the case. I don't know if it's that we're somehow the most technologically advanced, which doesn't seem likely. But I guess someone would have to be in a whole universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Someone has to be the most and someone has to be the least.
Yeah, there's a non-zero chance of that, for sure.
Yeah. And then it could be another thing where, like, they don't care or they don't want to meet us. So I don't know. I'm still stuck on which aliens exist answer I pick. But I will always lean towards the aliens exist answer. And in terms of my own personal beliefs, I've seen some weird stuff in the sky. I don't know if it's aliens, but I think I've seen some stuff that can't be explained by planes that I've seen, you know, just normal stuff, even military stuff that we know of. I think plenty of this stuff could be off the books sorts of things, whether it's our government or another government. Who's to say? But I know what I saw. And some of the movements and things that I've seen can't be easily explained because, you know, the speed, the maneuvers that I've seen happen. This is before drones were really popular.
I was going to say, that's what makes it tough now. Drones move like UFOs have always been described as moving.
Yes. I mean, yeah, just some crazy stuff. And I don't know if I believe that's aliens, but I believe that there certainly are UFOs and there's things that people aren't telling us, whether that's our government or another one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know if aliens have ever actually visited Earth. But to me, it's more likely than not any alien existing in the whole galaxy, if I had to choose between it, or the whole universe.
Yeah, the only problem for me with where a lot of conspiracy theories break down is I find it hard to believe a government as big as ours would be able to keep the secret for that long.
Well, the thing is, you could either write off a lot of these people as being unhinged, which there's never been someone unhinged in our government. Or you could say, well, these people that are saying there is weird stuff out there, they're telling the truth. Astronauts have said that. People that have had positions of power and intelligence in the government have said it. We just haven't really believed them. But that's a choice.
Yeah, but I've also never heard a report that you couldn't find something else a little bit more in keeping with my worldview to explain.
Yeah, but I'm sure you could do that about things that are true as well.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes, Sean, truth, stranger than fiction.
Well, of course. But I think the most likely thing, again, we don't understand physics very well on this planet. We don't understand anything very well. But what we understand suggests that you just can't move faster than the speed of light. So unless someone tells me that there's some good ways around that, I don't have a hard time believing that species might live a long time out here, get pretty advanced, you know, have...
But it's just so far away.
So far away, and they don't spread very far because everything's so far away.
So is that what you feel, that there's life in the universe?
Yeah, that is what I feel. Partly because I think the smartest people in this discussion, when you get your Carl Sagans and your Stephen Hawkings, and the smartest people all seem to, or the people the world agrees are the smartest, you know what I mean? The pop culture smartest, all seem to go like, yeah, of course, mathematically there has to be something out there. If Stephen Hawking says it, who am I to disagree?
And they believe in aliens, but they don't believe in God, so that'll tell you something. They always go by probability.
Yeah.
So if it's probable to them, why not me with my podcast?
Well, and that remember that 25,000 light years to the center of our galaxy, and that there's billions of galaxies? There's just so many stars.
There's no way that there's not anything else.
That's what I think.
It might as well be impossible.
But still non-zero. Mm.
True terrors of horror, bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
Connecticut's first ever paranormal convention is coming this summer.
Paracon!
Paracon will be held Saturday and Sunday, July 24th and 25th, 2021, at the haunted Ansonia Armory in Ansonia, Connecticut.
And guess who's going to be there?
This haunted weekend will feature special guests, paranormal investigations, seminars, panels, vendors, exhibits, and much, much more. Paracon is presented by Nick Grossman, head of Ghost Storm Investigations and collector of some of the rarest paranormal artifacts in the world, and Charles Rosenay, founder of Stratford's Fright Haven and director of Tours of Terror, ghost tours to Transylvania, Prague, England, and all over haunted Connecticut.
Yeah, we've been to Fright Haven. When we went, he had one of the rooms was all clown themed. It was a bunch of scary clown stuff, but you wore 3D glasses.
It was pretty cool. That was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, wasn't it?
Yes, they do seasonal offerings, not just Halloween. That was the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. It was a beautiful date.
Our first Valentine's Day. So who will be at Paracon? Guests include paranormal investigator Barry Pirro, author Bill Hall, who, you may remember, wrote The World's Most Haunted House, subject of episodes 17 and 18 of the podcast.
Yep, go check those out. Some of our very best work, mm-hmm. I think.
And us. Yeah, we'll be there too, in person, to chat all things scary, so come on down and meet us.
Oh, I guess I spoiled your surprise there. But yes, we will have a booth at Paracon, and we're so damn excited that we'll be there.
Yeah. Do you like to shop? Well, they'll have their own bazaar. Haunt artists, horror authors, cryptozoologists, artisans, occult sellers, and much more will be there. So bring some bones, the money kind, and a good pair of walking shoes.
You can bring the other kind of bones too if you want.
Yeah, maybe you can sell them. Who knows? We hope to see you there. Get your tickets now for only $9.99 per day through May 1st at www.paracon.org.
Is that a special deal for us, or is that just how cheap tickets are?
That's just how cheap tickets are until May 1st. Then it goes up like $5.
Oh, you guys.
Still a deal.
This is a bargain at any price.
Paracon, Connecticut's first paranormal convention. We're crying saucers. UFOs trended this week on Twitter as the CBS News magazine show 60 Minutes tackled the story of the U.S. government's grudging acknowledgement of unidentified aerial phenomena, more commonly known as UFOs.
This is searingly relevant this week.
It's a little too spicy for me. With a declassified report on UAPs due to be handed over to the Senate Intelligence Committee in June, 60 Minutes interviewed several big names, including Luis Elizondo, former head of the Pentagon's Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program.
Ooh.
Retired Navy Commander Dave Fravor, whose FA-18F squadron encountered a UAP in 2004, and Christopher Mellon, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Intelligence. So, Sean, these are people you're talking about. People in the government coming out and saying things.
Yep. Are any of them involved in Through the Stars Academy?
I don't think any of these are, but I didn't check. I didn't do my To the Stars Academy check. There was even new declassified footage shown by the television show showing a unidentified object flying off the coast of Florida, captured by the military. The visual, not the object.
I see.
Lieutenant Ryan Graves told the show that pilots training off the Atlantic coast see that thing all the time, stating, quote, every day for at least a couple years.
Wow.
When pressed if these objects could be Russian or Chinese technology, Graves responded, quote, I'm worried, frankly. You know, if these were tactical jets from another country that were hanging out up there, it would be a massive issue. But because it looks slightly different, we're not willing to actually look at the problem in the face. We're happy to just ignore the fact that these are out there watching us every day.
I don't know that he's saying that's an alien. He's just saying it's dangerous.
Yeah, he's saying it's a UFO.
It's unidentified.
Yeah. Senator Marco Rubio, who had initially pressed for the upcoming disclosure document, discussed the stigma about UFO intelligence senators face on Capitol Hill. Quote, I mean, some of my colleagues are very interested in this topic and some kinda, you know, giggle when you bring it up. But I don't think we can allow the stigma to keep us from having an answer to a very fundamental question. I want us to take it seriously and have a process to take it seriously. I want us to have a process to analyze the data every time it comes in. That there be a place where this is cataloged and constantly analyzed. Maybe a Project Blue Book.
I was going to say, and we'll call it Project Blue Book.
Until we get some answers. Maybe it has a very simple answer. Maybe it doesn't. I suppose we'll see, Sean, next month.
It's weird that they stopped Project Blue Book and they don't have, like, a replacement.
Yeah, it's almost suspicious.
No, but I...
Yeah, it's like, super weird. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And they stopped Project Blue Book at, like, the height of the Cold War? What are you thinking?
These are the same guys who put together the Warren Report. You know, what are you going to do?
And we all know that was a bunch of baloney. That's it for this episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ain't It Scary. And check out our website at ain'titscary.com. You can support the show by supporting our sponsors and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/ain'titscary. And please subscribe to the show and throw us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be forever grateful.
Yep. Special thanks to our beloved patrons, Nate Curtis, Sean O'Donnell, Jared Chamberlain, Maria Ferrante, Robin McCabe, and the newest boys on the block, Comfy Mike and James Harrington. Thanks, guys.
See you next Thursday.
Show created by Sean and Carrie McCabe. Music by Kyle Ryan. You can find Kyle at his YouTube channel, Music is a Verb.
This has been a production of Longboy Media.
My name is Cindy Burnett, and each week I interview at least 2 traditionally published authors on my podcast, Thoughts from a Page. We talk spoiler-free about their books, so you can listen whether you have read the book or not. And then we delve into things that you most likely won't hear about anywhere else. The importance of the cover design, why they included various aspects of the story, personal details about both the books and the authors' lives, and so much more. You can find the podcast on every major platform and learn more about it on my website, thoughtsfromapage.com. Thanks so much for checking it out.